recollection of what he's prepared him to, as he explains the things that he's found in your word, and help us to receive that and learn from it, that we might become better Christians, Lord. Be with those of our number who aren't able to be here with us today, and thank you for sending your son down to die on the cross for our sins. It's his name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. Today we're going to be talking about law within the Old Testament. We hear law within the Bible. New Testament talks about it as well. I mean, James talks about the perfect law of liberty. But generally speaking, when you hear the word law, it's referenced back to the Old Testament. Although I say the Old Testament, law can be used in a few different ways. On a very broad sense, sometimes when law is used, it might be just referring to the Old Testament as a whole. Often it's referring to law means those first five books of the Bible. That's where you find the law given at Sinai and expounded throughout Deuteronomy. So the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, oftentimes are just referred to as the law. This is how the Jews actually had their Bibles divided. Jesus, if you remember, he'll refer to the law, the prophets, and the writings, and how they testify about him. The law is that section, those first five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Sometimes they're also called, might run into the term Torah. Torah just means law. Sometimes they're called the Pentateuch. Pentateuch, if you think of a pentagram, it has five sides, if you remember your geometry. It's referring to a five. And so the Pentateuch is referring to the book of five. That's what it literally means, the book of five. So all of these things are where, when we think of law, it's referring back to Genesis through Deuteronomy. I want to begin today, though. Kind of funny. We've been talking about, we began this class, Eat This Book, and talking about the Bible and all of its portions and basically how to consume it, how to read it. We've been talking just about stories up to this point, or narratives. We talked about stories in the Old Testament, stories in the New Testament, and then we talked about parables. God likes stories, and obviously I do too, because we're talking about law, and then the first thing we're talking about are stories. I want to lead in that way. When I was putting everything together, it just kind of came together this way. And we're going to come around to it. I'm going to circle back around to it. Let me make this point, which I think it's something that we should recognize. We should have eyes that see, ears that hear. And we should recognize that the time and place that we stand historically within the historical point of Christianity for us, it's not in a very great place. We're in a very pluralistic world. We're in a world where Christianity, especially in the West, has been in decline for a little bit. It's in a place where you can't, there are some things that just in public, you cannot say from the Bible without some type of social or even worse consequences. That's just where we're at. I say all that to throw that out, that it's important that we recognize the bigger story that we're a part of. That Christianity, and even Judaism for the Jews, there is always more than just a set of laws or rules or regulations that you kept on a sheet of paper and you checked off when you did them, and you said, oh man, I'll do better when I mess up. Not that there's no part of Christianity in which we're self-reflective about our morals, but all of that takes place within a story, that we're part of a story. And this is how we're going to get back to law. Law, I want you to think about it. The law is given as part of a story. The law is given in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. It's retold in Deuteronomy. That is all part of an ongoing story that's happening. And we'll talk about the significance of that. The importance of us recognizing the importance of being part of a story, a lot of it is just we all have a part of us that wants to be a part of something bigger than we are. There's something driving, there's something that motivates us about that. there's always, everyone has a need to be a part of something bigger. And most of the time, most everybody that follows after something, they put it in terms of the story they're a part of. Let me throw it out this way. Let me give you two examples of this, because it's not just Christians that need to see themselves as part of a story. Everybody puts themselves into a bigger part of a story. And if we don't think that we're a part of a story, then it really just means we're living by the rules of somebody else's story. Okay, so in our world, one of the big narratives, one of the big stories that's going on is the story given to us in a world that just sees everything in terms of naturalistic, materialistic terms. That the world, the matter in it, that's all that exists. There's nothing transcendent, there's nothing spiritual, there's nothing deeper in us than a bunch of organs that are held together by cells. And this is, in our brain is just this 10-pound or however many pound organ in our head that generates all the feelings and all of this stuff. And that's just the way the world works. People are brought into this type of worldview. Most of the time, it's not just, or maybe not even, just looking at the facts on one side and the facts on the other. But it's through, it's you people tell that in terms of a story. And the story goes a little bit like this. Materialist, naturalistic worldview, the story goes like this. That once upon a time, people, well, what we got here, it was just happenstance that we got here. Over time, we evolved. And as people, we've been evolving as well. Used to, we believed in all kinds of gods everywhere. We were polytheists. There were gods everywhere. And these gods, they didn't really disagree. They were kind of... They weren't really moral or anything like that. And we operated on these Stone Age morality principles where might makes right, all of those things. Eventually, though, this story is what's called a subtraction story. Eventually, we subtracted out some of those gods. People eventually realized that, hey, maybe we have too many gods. Let's just minus out some of those and get down to one god. And so you have Judaism, you have Christianity, you have Islam. And once you subtract out all of these other gods, well, it's a little bit easier to start having some type of law or rules that everybody's going to follow. And people, even atheists, will recognize, however much they hate Christianity or Judaism or Islam, a lot of times they'll observe and recognize that at least the morality in this is a little bit better. And in their view, it's a little bit better than some of those polytheistic religions. But then we operate under that principle, serving the Christian God or serving the Jewish God, on and on and on, until about the 1600s, 1700s, and the Enlightenment came. And we started observing the world, and we could just start explaining stuff just based on the physical principles of the world. And all that's really happened between then and now is we've just subtracted one more God out of the picture. And that's how we are now. And the way that we get to a better future is just making sure that all the other people in the world subtract out that final God that they've been worshiping. And then we can all agree on something. We can all get to our man-made paradise. So that's a story that goes on. And just like any other stories, there are certain heroes, there are certain people that stood up to the persecuting church, or there are certain turning points in that history. But it's part of a story, and people will tell that story. There's also another narrative that's going on within our world as well. One of the other big narratives that we deal with and we battle against, and it's the story that we see within the sexual revolution. And that story kind of goes like this, that at one time, life was good. We were hunter-gatherers. We were kind of one with nature. We were in nature. We were like the animals. There weren't all of these sexual inhibitions. There weren't all of these things that crowd out our lives and make it confine us and constrict us. But then over time, what ended up happening is problems started entering in. Once we started forming cities and other types of things, we started worshiping gods. And there started being things like patriarchy or any of this or that. And these things, especially religion, they started making us act in prudish ways and started making us constrict our inner selves. And the solution to that And the path that we've been on for maybe the last few hundred years is we've seen that we really need to be uninhibited from the constraints that we have. We need to be able to express ourselves sexually. We need to express ourselves in other types of ways. And again, as a story does, it has heroes. There are certain people that stood up to the powers. It has certain turning points. It has a vision for the future. Those type of things, obviously, I don't think anybody in here says that's the story that I want to be a part of. But the reason that people do side in those types of ways is because it's a compelling story. It's a story that at least it puts together pieces. It tells a story to people that people, if they want to buy in, they can buy in. Christianity and the Bible, it presents us a story. It presents us a true story that we're a part of. In other words, that when we operate as Christians in the world, we're not doing it divorced from the past or divorced from people that have gone before us. And it's important that we recognize that we're part of this long line of Christians, that we're part of this line of Christians, and not just a part of Christians, but back to the Israelites as well, that our story traces itself back to the moment when God appeared to Abraham and said, I'm going to redeem mankind from the sin that they're in. And so stories, they're powerful, they're important. They give us a motivating reason to do what we do. They give us a connection point to people in the past that we're not alone in the world. I do think that part of, and this isn't just me saying, this is something I've listened to others say over time as well. I think part of the reason if we see Christianity fading, and there's all kinds of reasons for that, but one of the reasons for that is if we're not telling that story to our kids or keeping that story within our own hearts, then there's other compelling stories that people are going to find, to grasp, and to go for. For us, all stories, they have a how did it start, what went wrong, and how to fix it. And for us, it started with God creating us out of love. It went wrong through sin, and it's Jesus, the solution, that's going to fix it. In the law, this is the moment where you see God stepping into history and showing that it's not just a story that he's left us alone to do what we want to do, that God stepped in and he's the transcendent God has stepped in to guide us on that path. Let me stop for a moment if there's, and talk for a bit of the comments or questions or thoughts.
Carl. I think it's interesting that you know, there are only, I guess, a few nations around the world that have really managed to hold on to their story for thousands of years. And Israel is one. And that speaks back to the power of what God did when he took them and made them a people and what we see in the Torah. Not just the story that he gave them, but also the memorials and the rituals that he gave them, especially around their identity, around Passover. Around circumcision and those things. I mean, I think the only other nations that even try are you know, maybe somebody like Egypt or somebody like China. I mean, there are some ancient, right? But most of the nations that were other nations we read about in the Bible, they're just gone.
Yeah.
Right? Their stories didn't last.
Yeah.
But this story did.
Yeah.
To that point, I can't remember the numbers, but I heard it passing this week. A recent poll was found, in spite of the trends of people continuing to stop attending church services and synagogues, I believe it was focused on Jews and Christians, but while people continue to stop attending these services, they had disproportionately high remaining value on Passover and, I believe Easter, but it was asking about specific holidays. Of course, you know, we don't practice Easter as a religious holiday, but the fact that people still view it as significant speaks to that point, and your broader point, that the stories matter and have retained that history for thousands of years. People still see value in that, even if they're not willing to live it out in their day-to-day lives.
This may not be as stories you say, but I had a friend in a place where I used to worship, and she set up her daughter going to a big university, and one of her professors, this was years ago, that one of her professors told her, as she was in a big university where there's thousands, and this class, there were hundreds in the class, and the professor the first day says, if you believe in God, when you're done with my class, you won't. And her daughter said, thank God that I was so grounded in the church, because it was true. If I hadn't been, I wouldn't by the end of this class. And that is so true, because we don't, sometimes parents don't tend to ground their children in the Lord. And of course, sometimes it's not at the fault of the parents, but it's true, because they tend to atheist or tend to drive you away from
them. Yeah. Yeah. Terry.
Sadly, too, the image of Christianity is that of some of these mega churches that are around that don't preach anything related to the gospel, but just preach having a good time, being nice to each other, and so forth, and don't get into, I mean, they have a message which brings everybody in, but there's a challenge there.
Yeah.
And the other image that a lot of people have is, if you have to turn on TV late at night or something, there's several of them that are on there that their whole message is, give me. You know, if you give me money, God will bless you.
Yeah.
And so the message, there's so many conflicting messages out there that are viewed by society under the umbrella of Christianity, that ours is hard to hear sometimes.
Yeah. So, Carl?
And one more thing, national stories, and holding on to that national identity, you know, as you were talking about the other stories that are going through culture now, or have come to be seen as problems, right? I mean, people think that the world wars in the 20th century were due to nationalism. And so what we need to do is we need to get rid of those stories. And then people can just be part of one big story.
Yeah.
They see those as problems that need to be gotten rid of.
Yeah. Yeah. In a phrase that comes up a lot, and it's a kind of a put down. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history. In other words, if you stand against this view, you're on the wrong side of history. That assumes, discard whatever views are being espoused or not. But that assumes that we want to be, I mean, history itself, it has that word story as part of it. You want to be on it's the idea that you want to be on the right side of history, because if you're on the right side of history, it means you're part of an ongoing story. If you're on the wrong side of history, you're part of a story that's going to end. I think, funny enough, I think it was actually maybe one of the, it might have been Khrushchev or one of the Soviet Union leaders that, I don't know if he quite said Americans are going to be on the wrong side of history, or he said something, I think it was part of his speech when he said that we're going to bury you with history or whatever. Sometimes you think the other side is going to be on the wrong side of history, but it's actually your side. The law is given as a story. We're not going to go to all these Bible passages, just especially for one of time. But you remember that the law, it starts to be given to Moses midway through the book of Exodus. And Moses is on Sinai. But remember that in all of these laws, it's interrupted by the actual fact that there's something going on. This is part of a narrative. It's not just like this code that's given, that's, we have no idea when it was given or anything like that. Moses on Sinai, and then God, in the middle of it, he says, Moses, get down there. I'm about to blast these people to oblivion because they're already disobeying. They're already worshiping a false god. So he goes down there in Exodus 32 and deals with the golden calf. As you continue on, they build the tabernacle in the beginning of Leviticus. Moses comes to God in the tabernacle, and this is all of Leviticus. We think of it as just this boring, long code of stuff. It's actually part of a story. It's part of a long dialogue where God is giving Moses laws. And this is why you have around Leviticus 10, where Nadab and Abihu, you have Nadab and Abihu that enter into the story. They do something that's really messed up. Later on, the laws continue, but in Leviticus chapter 24, you're going to have this man who commits blasphemy. And it's again, it enters back into what we normally think of as story. So law is something that's centered in, there's a time and place that it was given, and it was meant for Jews in all times and places, or Israelites in all times and places. But again, it's rooted in something that's a story. Now, this is important because what it means is that it's one of the many instances of God coming down from heaven, of the transcendent God entering into history, because God is outside of time and space, but him entering into the realm of mankind to make his presence known. This is important because in the ancient world, law is not a new thing. And in the ancient world, gods are not a new thing either. In the ancient world, you had laws and you had gods. Laws, they're even laws. If you remember school at all, you might have come across the Hammurabi Code. Hammurabi was a king of Babylon. I don't remember exactly when he was living. It might have been around the time of Abraham, give or take, maybe a little bit after, maybe a little bit before. But he was living within the ancient world, and he had a set of laws that his people were following. And in many ways, there's similarities between some of the Exodus, Leviticus, between law in the Bible and the laws of Hammurabi. There are other types of codes that people had as well. The Bible wasn't the first place to come up with a type of law. But there's something unique about it, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The rest of the world, they also had gods. You had gods that you worship, you serve. You had temples that you built for these gods. Many of the temples that other nations had, they would have even resembled the Israelites' temple. The difference is that between the plural and the singular, nations had laws and nations had gods, but God's people had law and God's people had God. Within the ancient world, these two things did not go together. Law and God did not go together. The gods that you served, the reason that you really offer sacrifices to them was just to keep them off your back. You hoped that they would help you in war. You hoped that they would help you with fertility. And you really just didn't want to offend them. You didn't want to speak blasphemy about Zeus or Hera or anything like that, because you might get a lightning bolt in your back at some point in time. But other than that, gods, they didn't make laws, because frankly, the gods were just about as bad as people were. And if you just think about the Greek gods, committing adultery, committing affairs, committing murder, being spiteful, being jealous. Those gods couldn't make any type of law at all. All they could really demand of you is just show me some honor, just show me some respect. And so people, they had gods in one category. And if they were going to have laws, which you always have to have laws if you live in a society, you have to have laws to protect, especially the weaker, to protect other people. But laws and other things that you set in place, they were given by men. And they were for men. Hammurabi's code, whatever similarities it had to Exodus or Leviticus, it was by a man. And at the end of the day, the only way that's enforced is just because Hammurabi is at the top of that totem pole. And might makes right, and Hammurabi and the people under him had the power to enforce that law. But there's nothing transcendent about it. Nothing that said this law has to apply to every person everywhere, because it was just made by one man. Whereas law within the Bible, when God gives that law to Moses at Sinai, this is something that, I mean, you go back to the ancient world, this just didn't happen, where gods were concerned about more than just having some bulls and lambs killed for them, that he actually cared about how his people acted and how that God was also going to punish his people if they acted outside of how of the laws that he gave them. And part of this we know as well, that God created all people, and it was important that other people, if you're made in God's image, then it's important. You keep God's law in treating other people in that type of way, that you love your neighbor as yourself, because they are made in God's image, and God cared about that as well. And so this is the unique thing with law in the Old Testament, is it's both, it's God giving the law, and these aren't two separate things, and God cares about the morality of his people as well. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. And this is what God says about his own law in Deuteronomy 4, verses 1 through 8. Carl, could you read Deuteronomy 4, verses 1 through 8? Or wait, is that what I said?
Deuteronomy 4, 1 through 8?
What did I say? Deuteronomy 4, 1 through 8, yeah.
Okay, that's what you said.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor. For the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal Peor. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day?
So those verses 6 through 8 of chapter 4 are key in a lot of ways, that the law was a way, it was through the law that they were meant to be a light to the nations around them. And again, because it's something unique within the ancient world, that the Israelites weren't just claiming that they had a law to follow or a law code. They had a law that was given to them by God, which all the other nations, again, they would have had gods that they served and just tried to not step on their toes. And they would have had laws that were given to them by men, but they wouldn't have a God who's descending down, who's deigning to be with his people and give them a law to follow themselves. So something new has happened. And the Israelites were meant to be a light to the nations as well. And this is one of the ways in which the law was supposed to guide them. Any other thoughts or anything else we see in Deuteronomy 4, these 8 verses, about what law meant to them or what it should have meant to them?
It's also unusual of God's law. As the nations came and went, even with Nebuchadnezzar, he kept changing his mind. We don't need to bow down for this. You don't need to do this. You can't do this. The law kept changing. God's law has been the same until the death of Christ. Now we have the will of the Lord, or the law of the Lord, and it doesn't change. Our nation, that use the word Christian nations, that they have no idea what being a follower of Christ is. They follow their, same as Babylonians, they follow their leaders. So they call false religions. But God's law has always been consistent.
Carrie.
From your description there, the conclusion that I drew was that
earlier, gods were created in man's image and behaved the way man did. But followers of God recognized that they were created in his image. That was the different thing. The people who had the many gods anthropomorphized their God. They created God like they were, instead of being created like God was.
Yeah, and to a great extent, you know, the kings took upon themselves divine authority, right? I mean, the gods had made me king, so I can rule, and so my authority, the authority that I exercise is given to me by the gods, and then of course, so will the next one, and so will the next one, and so they change. In the law given by God to Moses, it's a high moral law, really. It's not the kind of thing that we're going to come up with as we talk about each other, even though God does make some allowances in there as around marriage and divorce, you know, and other things that he does make allowance because of the hardness of their hearts and knows that they're not going to be perfect. But it is a high moral calling, to which they're called, that God has set forward, and it emanates. It's not random, because it emanates from who he is,
yeah,
and his character, and for his people to be like him.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes. I think Carrie had mentioned making gods in our own image. Sometimes it's kind of funny that Christians get that charge is leveled against Christians as well, or really any for people that don't believe in God at all. That the charge is often leveled that anyone that believes in a God, that all they've really done is made a God in their image, whether it's the one true God we serve, or whether it's Zeus and Hera and Apollo and everything else. There's the reality of it is, if Christianity is true, and I firmly 100% believe and know it's true, if God made people in his image, and there's always going to be some likeness between God and people. That doesn't, but there's something fundamentally different between God making us in his image and us making gods in our own image. You see this again especially with the polytheistic religions, with using the Greek gods as a whipping boy. But you see this with Norse gods. You see this with polytheistic religions. They just act as bad as people. They're not anything different than people, except you need to tiptoe a little bit carefully around them, because they can drop you dead in an instant. Whereas God, the God who we don't make in our image, but makes us in our image, there's no possible way that we would have made, that we would have created that God ourselves. Because frankly, I just don't want to, I hope you recognize I'm speaking somewhat rhetorically here, but I don't want to have a God that tells me I can't act in this type of way. I don't want a God that tells me that I need to be faithful to my spouse and only that spouse. I don't want a God telling me that if I want something, I just can't have it. I can't take that or steal that. In other words, it's the way that people act and the way that people live. There's no real reason why we would want to create a God that then confines and constrains us. And so that's kind of the fundamental problem that people have to deal with if they try to level that charge against Christians or against the Abrahamic religions, that you just constructed this God in your image. Because God is, as God reminds us all throughout the law as well, that be holy as I am holy. In other words, he's holy and we're not holy, and we're supposed to be like him who is holy. So go to Galatians chapter 3. This ties into the comment that Mark made of the law being something that leads us to Christ, a new law beginning with Christ. Galatians chapter 3. Galatians 3. And I will read Galatians 3, verses 23 through 29. where Paul writes this. He writes, before faith came, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed. So then the law was our guardian until Christ came in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. For in Christ Jesus, you are all sons of God through faith. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free. There is no male or female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. So the verse that I want to focus on, and then we'll use that in the time that we have remaining today and also next week as well, is that verse 24, the law was our guardian or a tutor until Christ came. In other words, the law was good, and Paul's going to deal with this all throughout. Paul's going to deal with this, especially in Galatians and especially in Romans. He's going to deal with this issue in other books as well, that the law is not a bad thing. But the law was not meant to be there for forever. It was, on one hand, meant to be like a tutor or a guardian, someone that led you or guided you to adulthood. But once you became an adult, there's no problem. Elementary school teachers are good. Middle school teachers are good. But if you keep that same teacher all the way until you're an adult, still teaching the same lessons over and over and over, there's something not good about that. And that's the point that he's making with the law. One of the things that the law does is it bridges this gap. It's kind of a funny thing. I told you about those stories. If we want to call it the story of the sexual revolution or the story of naturalism or a materialistic view of the world, part of the thing that makes those stories compelling is that there are kernels of real actual truth in there. At one point, there was a time, speaking of the sexual revolution story, there was a time where man and woman were naked before each other and were not ashamed in Eden. On the naturalistic, materialistic side, which has just a subtraction story, which basically says used to, there were a lot of gods, and then we just subtracted a lot out, and there was one God, and now we fell into place. We just take that God and kick him to the curb as well. Even within that, there's a kernel of truth that at one point in time, prior to Abraham, people had gone their own way, just serving whatever gods there were. And God did step into history and do something phenomenal with guiding Abraham and showing him himself as the one true God and the only God that is one. And so what the law effectively does is within this world, this polytheistic world where people just serve whatever they feel like and whatever they please, God, through the law, is revealing himself as transcendent and outside of time and space. And he's guiding them all the way, ultimately, to Christ. And I think this is one of the reasons Carl talks about allowances being made for divorce, other types of things within the law. Even within the law, we look at it, the Old Testament, we say, okay, there's some things in here that are a little bit weird. There's some wonky things here. And we'll talk about some of those wonky things, I think, next week. When we get to it. But part of the reason we have to recognize this as well is what the world, and there's other passages that indicate this as well. The world was just not ready for Christ at that time. I think that's the indication we get throughout the Bible, that if he had sent Jesus Christ into the world in the days of Abraham, it just, in all of God's wisdom and knowledge, it just wouldn't have been the right time. And the law serves as a way to guide his people, to show them what God is like before he fully and truly reveals himself in the person of Christ. And so the law is like a guardian. It's kind of like this as well. This is how we bring up kids. Okay, when we think of the law, compare it to the New Testament, one of the big things that we notice differently is just the exhaustiveness of the law in the laws. I don't remember how many laws. It's something like 613 or something like that, 613 laws that the rabbis said are in the Old Testament. The New Testament, it's not that there aren't instructions on what to do and what not to do, but they're not in the same way. They're not in the same exhaustiveness. And I'll say this as well, for law, Laws can never address every single instance, even within something as exhaustive as the Old Testament. They can't address every single instance. At the end of the day, you have to use wisdom. You have to use your brain. But this is what a guardian or a tutor does. If you think of the Israelites being God's people in their infancy, and we need to think of Christians as Christians, we should be people that have come to maturity just within the long scope of God's plan. If the Israelites were God's people in infancy, where he pulled them out of the world in a world that didn't know them and began to reveal himself to them, parents, they teach this way. When you have kids, you don't really teach them. You don't teach them a lot of why. You just teach them, do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that. Don't touch the pan. You might tell them because it's hot. They're going to end up having to learn what hot is when they just really mess up. But you tell them, don't go in the road. You're not going to explain them how traffic laws work and everything like that. You're not going to explain to them when it is okay to cross the road, at least not early on. The Old Testament, it kind of functions in this type of way. It just gives a lot of commands about do this, don't do that. And don't get me wrong, it goes into, in some of these cases, it goes into why these laws are in place. But a lot of times, the way that we figure out why are these laws in place is we have to figure it out the way that we would look at a parent instructing their child. As an adult, we know why a parent says don't go into the road or don't touch the hot pan. But that's only something that we learn after. And so the Old Testament, being as a guardian, it basically gives a framework that you can build on. Next week, and if you have comments, keep them. You can make them in just a moment. Next week, I was thinking that we would hit the Ten Commandments, but and we might do that at the end. But especially what I want to address are the dietary laws in Leviticus, Leviticus 11, for instance. And I want to talk about laws that deal with death and staying away from death. And we're going to see, it demonstrates this principle of a guardian just saying, do this, don't do this. This is what you need to know. These are the basic principles before you can think outside the box. God doesn't necessarily give a reason for why he gives the dietary laws or why he gives the laws on death. But we can see there's passages we can compare it against that we can start to understand why these things were in place. And then if we have time, we'll go to the Ten Commandments as well. But staying on that, thinking about the law as a guardian or a tutor, are there other thoughts or comments about how it acted in this way? Cameron?
Yeah, as a tutor, to Carl's earlier point about the laws they emanate from God's character. As I think about that, I think there is a sense in which we didn't really fully understand that until Jesus came. Because what the laws were a list of true things. They were teaching us truth in some capacity, but we couldn't fully understand the significance of that until Jesus came and literally told us, I am truth. Yeah. I am the truth.
Yeah.
And as you preached this morning, now that you've seen me, you have seen the Father. It connected everything. So we have the benefit of seeing that and looking back at the law and say, hey, this is what Paul's explaining. But I think when you look at the way they tremble before Mount Sinai, they largely view God the same way as we do this out of honor for me because I said so.
Yeah.
But then Jesus came and filled in things that we couldn't possibly understand to your broader point.
Yeah.
We couldn't possibly understand.
Yeah, good point. Other thoughts or comments?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of things that they needed to know. I mean, God's going to take them out of the world, and God's going to make them his people. And so he's going to have to beat into their heads what he is like, that he is not like the other gods that men make. God is this. God is holy.
Yeah.
Sin separates you from God. Sin is something that there has to be dealt with, and sanctification is required before you can approach me again.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain fundamental things that have it has to get through to them.
Yeah. And this is my government is about to ring that bell. This is how one of the ways that we approach law. We don't follow law in the same way that they did then. But it doesn't mean that we tear those pages out of our Bible and we say we don't need this because this is frankly just a lot bigger than our New Testament. Let's just stick with the New Testament. It's kind of like a child. When you're an adult, you learn trigonometry and you learn calculus. You learn other maths that build on the basic principles. You don't have to go back to the counting tables of 2 + 3 = 5 and on and on and on. But you better know that stuff before you get into the deeper maths. And I think it's the same with law and when we get into the New Testament. We need to know those lessons within the law. Thank you for your time.